This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
All right, it's good to have you back with us again. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you're doing well. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. We're in for a busy week here at RedIceCreations.com. A few extra shows for you later in the week. And don't forget our new Radio 314 as well. Latest guest, Tom Montauk. That's available right now. Today we have writer Alex Newman with us. He's written articles for a number of different publications, such as The New American, Liberty Magazine, Crisis Magazine, and many more, on the issues of liberty, freedom, and world government. Today, Alex, who also part-time lives in Sweden, is with us to expose Sweden's big government utopia and how the nightmare now is spreading. Well, as you guys perhaps know, lately I've been bitching, if I can use that word, quite a bit about Sweden, and understandably, many people still believe that Sweden has been a utopia of equality and welfare, where everybody's almost to the point of being rich. Money grows on trees, but also kind of a society where the people don't really care about money, but for the welfare of each other. We have been UN approved as it is. And it's one of the best countries in the world to live in. We always get this title according to, or together with Norway. It kind of, you know, people mix together Scandinavia or the Nordic countries in most cases. But what we are going to talk about here is about the Nordic model partially as well. So, you know, we don't really have a Solzhenitsyn as well, or anyone else like that, to speak up against the socialist corporatism that we live in here, and the million program gulags that were built here in the 70s and 60s, where most people simply exist in. So if you don't have any voices of critique, then you might think it's a great country out there if you never visited. And if you have visited, even you might actually just have the perception, the peripheral view of it, so to speak. And again, I'm not saying that this is on the level of Soviet Russia or anything like that. It's more subtle, refined. It's a, as I've said before, a scientific dictatorship, scientific suppression, if you will. It's more difficult to spot it. It's a more patient dictatorship. It's one primarily, I think, run by bureaucracy. And therefore, also, it's, in my view, more dangerous. It's a tyranny that is difficult to see because it's moving at a glacial speed. So anyhow, we have a very talented writer with us here today, a dissident, if you will, who indeed is speaking out against much of this, the subtle but very effective destruction of the small differences that exists within Swedish society. Alex Newman, who writes for a number of different publications and online magazines, is with us today. Good to have you with us, Alex. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. This is going to be really interesting. I stumbled over some of your work a while back, and I immediately realized that at least partially we're on the same page, if you will, and we've been critiquing and writing and talking about this for a little bit, and I think you probably longer than me, perhaps. So I just want to ask you about some of the basics here in the beginning. How did you get onto this track, Alex, and how long have you been writing about Sweden and the government system here?
Well, I've been writing for probably about 7 or 8 years, professionally at least, since I was in university studying journalism. It so happens that my wife is Swedish, and so that's kind of my connection to Sweden. That's why I spend a good part of the year here and why I have a house here. And once I got here and started settling down and meeting people and that kind of stuff, I, you know, took a look around and started getting emails from people who had problems with Sweden. And so I kind of looked into it and, you know, formed my own perspective, I guess you could say.
You bet. I'm going to talk about some of that here today. It's mostly foreigners, interestingly enough, it seems like, that are critical of the way Sweden is being run. The populace, the people itself, seems to be very, maybe not content. They can, I would say they complain in their own way, but it's not a quality of the Swedes to be outspoken about this. Is something you've noticed as well?
Absolutely. The conformity here, I think, is maybe unprecedented in the world, because even in dictatorships, at least people, you know, mumble under their breath about it. They talk about it over the dinner table, that kind of stuff. But here in Sweden, it's just so taboo to criticize any element of the system, because it seems like criticizing any one element of the system to them automatically equates as criticism of the whole model. And they've invested so much in this model. You know, they're so attached to it since birth. They've been raised, you know, in the government schools thinking that this is the best way to do it and so forth. And so when you attack any piece of it, they consider it an attack on the whole. And so, yeah, I mean, it can result in, you know, animosity and even ostracism.
It's almost like it's an attack on themselves in some cases, I've noticed. If you begin to criticize the system, it's like you attack them personally, because again, as you say, they're so attached to it and such a part of it that it thinks like, well, I am the system. I and all we of us together create this, what we've, you know, come to associate with here. Therefore, it's almost like a personal attack, which is very unfortunate, I would say.
Absolutely. It's a very collectivist mindset, I think, that takes these kind of criticisms personally. I mean, I love my country. I'm American. I absolutely love my country. I love the Constitution. But I'm extremely critical of what the government is doing. And it's just preposterous for someone to associate criticism of, you know, a governing system with criticism of people or criticism of an individual in particular. It's the system that we're talking about here, not an attack on an individual person. Almost every Swede I know is a very good person, pretty moral people for the most part. And so it is disappointing that people take the system so personally when anybody offers any criticism.
It's true, but I've seen that beginning to happen around the world as well. America is being associated with Americans now, right?
Yeah, actually, I think that's very unfortunate too, that this collectivist mindset where kind of, you know, the American government is doing something, so then immediately the American people are to blame. And of course, we do have to accept some responsibility for it. This is our government. They're doing these things with our tax money. And at least in theory, we voted for them and so forth. So, you know, we might have to take some degree of responsibility for it, but that's a collective thing. As an individual, I didn't participate in the creation of this system. I didn't authorize it. I didn't sign any social contract authorizing it to act in my name. And so people really have to start separating the individual from the collective and realize that, you know, if the rulers are bad, that doesn't necessarily say anything about the people.
Very good. So simple when you think about it in that way. What are some of the biggest problems that you see with Swedish society? I want to get into details about this. I also want to discuss how potentially you see that this system now is being exported to the other parts of the world. I've been interested in this primarily because it draws in more people than just the Swedes. I mean, to a certain extent, I've found it practically impossible talking with the Swedes. The majority. I mean, there's always people who break the mold and who break this, collectivist attitude that we've been talking about. But again, if we generalize, it's very, very difficult to go through that. Therefore, that's partially also one of the reasons why I chose to do this in English and talk to an international, if you will, then audience that indeed can speak the language. But again, then, what are some of the biggest problems that you see with Swedish government systems, society at large, and also how people have been shaped by that, Alex?
Well, I think the root of the problem is just a lack of respect for individual rights. There's this, you know, what I consider a bizarre fascination with the term democracy, that if the majority of people, 51% or more, voted for something, that suddenly it's legitimate to do absolutely anything. And I think that's the root of the problem. Now, I'll go into the specific problems that I see in a little bit, but when you have this kind of system where the individual and the individual's rights don't mean anything, then you set the stage for all kinds of abuses. So in the U.S., I cite the U.S. because that's my country, we have, you know, the Bill of Rights, where you have the right to this and this and this, and these are unalienable rights. They existed before the government existed. The government exists only to protect those rights. Sweden doesn't really have that kind of foundation. So if the government subsidized newspapers and the government subsidized education system can, you know, convince 51% of the people that, hey, we should ban homeschooling or we should infringe on any other individual right, then the population accepts it as legitimate. And I think that's somewhere that it's an area that there really needs to be a fundamental break here. People need to say individuals have these rights and they're off limits. It doesn't matter if, you know, 98% of the people think we should censor newspapers, for example. That's just off limits. We have freedom of speech, and as individuals, these rights existed before government was created, and we created government to accomplish the protection of these rights. And so we need to have certain areas that are off limits. And I think what what might benefit Sweden a lot is to have a type of constitutional system. I know you guys have a grundlag or whatever, but
right.
that can be overridden with what, 51% vote in parliament. So that's not the type of thing I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that just guarantees that these rights are inalienable and they just cannot be touched by politicians. They cannot be touched by the majority. And that leads to more harmony in society, I think. You know, people don't have to worry about what their neighbor's doing. Just everybody lives their own free life. And as long as you're not violating anybody else's rights, then there's no problem.
It's I want to discuss this individual aspect here as well. And how you see that this is visible within society, because I think there is a disconnect for most people, because if you live within the parameters that are drawn for you as an individual, if I can put it that way, then things are seemingly okay. It really is when you're at the edge of that, for different reasons, ideologically, even religiously or what have you, things that was okay by the government and the mass one day, but the next one, for some reason, it's not okay. Like homeschooling, for instance, that you brought up, very, very important. So it's when you're at the edge of that you realize how incredible disrespectful of the individual, actually exists. But if you're not at that perimeter, it's perhaps, what do you think, Alex, very, very difficult to notice that anything is wrong, if I can put it that way.
I think that's probably true, yeah. If you've never thought outside the box, to use a metaphor, then you might never even come across any of this. You know, the Swedish news media doesn't report it. They're all on the government payroll. And so you almost create a sense of blindness to these kinds of abuses that are going on. As long as you fit in and as long as you don't go outside of these boundaries, then you don't have a problem. But the second you take one step over and, for example, try to educate your children at home or try to have a politically incorrect opinion, then you're going to find yourself in the crosshairs. And then when you try to warn others, they're going to ridicule you. They don't really care because they've never encountered anything like that. They've never been informed of anything like that. And their mindset is different than, say, somebody who believes firmly in individual rights or somebody who wants to operate outside the box in a way that isn't violating anybody's rights, but in a way that isn't seen as acceptable by political leaders, we can say.
Have you noticed at all that individualism seems to go hand in hand with, maybe difficult to define some of these terms because I don't really know what the general mindset is out there. I've been trying to think outside of the box for a long time, but I could imagine that it's in some regard, it's associated with being egotist or egotistical in your outlook on life. It might even be associated with some, not that the philosophy or the concept of this extends this far, but it's almost like, well, when you talk about individuals, you're in the realm of, you know, Ayn Rand and some of these people, and then that's almost like it's associated with something dangerous. That's what I'm trying to get to. Have you noticed that that's the consensus out there here in Sweden?
Absolutely. The individualism tends to be, I think, associated here with things like greed and things like, you know, exploitation of people by capitalism and so forth. And I think what needs to happen is just a redefinition of terms here, because if they can label, you know, I don't want to call it an ideology per se, but if they can label individualism with all these unsavory terms, then it becomes hard to even have a discussion because people have these preconceived notions about what you're even talking about. And they have these little keywords that when they hear them, their mind automatically thinks back to these things. And so it becomes difficult to even have a proper discussion on this without eliciting all kinds of emotional responses that are actually hard to deal with when you're trying to use reason and logic to make your point.
Has this been a strategy, do you think, from the political elite, if we can term it that, in Sweden, to associate certain of these ideal, concepts with these words?
You know, you mentioned earlier the concept of a scientific dictatorship, and I think that's a very, very good description of what's going on here. There was a lot of thought that went into the creation of this system. There was a lot of studies done. There was a great deal of resources and, like I said, thought poured into this experiment. And so I think they covered all their bases, and I think that was one of the approaches. From what I know of Swedish government schools, for example, even when you're talking about preschool teachers, they study a guy called Vygotsky. He was a Soviet scientist whose goal in life was to create a new type of human who would frown on anything to do with an individual and would exist just to work for the collective. So they get these little tiny Swedish kids, 1-year-old, 2-year-old, into this government-run system. And just from the time they can't, before they can even speak, they're already getting these ideas into them. And that continues up until, you know, they graduate from high school, then they get into the university, and then it's just slightly more advanced. And it, you just end up with a society where everybody is conformist, and questioning it is viewed as radical, or is viewed as, like you said, an attack on an individual Swede rather than on this system. And I think it's hard. I think it's easier for me to see this because I come in as an outsider. I have, I wasn't raised in this system. I have a completely different perspective as an American. And, you know, I think it really is hard to try to explain this to people when you're trying to show them, you know, put your preconceived notions aside. Well, to tell that someone who's had these notions implanted in them from the time they're 1 or 2 years old, it's a very, very difficult task.
I want to get into the history of this, but before we do that, I want to ask you about this idea that also now many Americans are looking towards Sweden as being almost like a role model. It's a fantastic society over there. Haven't you heard? And I mean, even I've been looking at some of the media, have been, you know, coming across some of this nonsense, in all fairness, in the last couple of years, where the system is being promoted in different kind of ways on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. It's musicians are talking about it, like Bruce Springsteen. There's others, professors in economics from Duke and Harvard, I think, that did a study a while back about the fact that Americans, according to their study, that Americans prefer a so-called wealth redistribution plan similar to that of Sweden. But my point has always been, if they were to live here, if they were just as you, Alex, would have moved here and lived here for a while, they would have seen the flip side of this. What can you say about the promotion of the system abroad?
Well, I've come across that a lot, actually. When I was in university, I can't tell you how many times I heard professors talking about the wonders of socialist utopia Sweden. And it's ironic in some ways, because in some ways Sweden has actually become less of a welfare state than the United States, less of a redistributionist state than the United States.
Yeah.
Not in all ways, but in a lot of ways. I think it has more to do with self-preservation of the system. But what you said about using Sweden as a model for the world, I think is exactly on point. I think the Swedish system has been developed with a mind toward exporting it abroad. Now, the Swedish government does this itself. They have, I think it's called the Swedish Institute. It's a tax-funded government agency that goes around promoting the Swedish system, that goes around monitoring public opinion around the world as it relates to the Swedish system. And so I think, if you want to call them the insiders, the people who are kind of totalitarian-minded and have a view toward ruling the world, I think they see the Swedish system as perhaps the ideal, because what you have here is a whole population of people who are so attached to this. I don't want to call it slavery. Maybe that's a little bit harsh, but they they love the system, and just the thought of questioning it makes them upset. So that is, I mean, totalitarians throughout history have, you know, longed for a kind of system like this where you could impose whatever you wanted without any resistance. And it's just, you know, a genius system if that's what your goal is. And I definitely agree that it's being promoted around the world. And the UN does that as well. They consistently rank Sweden as some kind of, you know, paradise for the world to emulate. And third world countries look at Sweden and they say, oh, well, they're pretty rich. And, you know, they have this big welfare system and so on. Maybe if we do that here, then we'll end up with a similar outcome. And like you mentioned, if you come here and experience it personally, you might have another view of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is what's making it so insidious, the tactics. It's more sinister than a, full-on tyrannical dictatorial government. Because then, as you said before, then you at least know what you're facing. You know who your enemy is. But this is a dictatorship with a velvet glove. It's a padded one that seems on the surface to care and tend for you. And in a way, that's true. But it's also very, very restrictive, because it's nice to you if you follow the rules and do what it says that you should do. But again, then we're not talking about people who are, you know, criminals, quote unquote. Here, we're talking about people who are just breaking the regular molds. That it's very, very difficult for them to basically just live their lives. How would you define this, Alex?
I think the way that the system was designed appeals to certain human emotions. A lot of people don't really like to take responsibility. And that's, of course, sad. Not everybody's like this, obviously. But if you're the type of person who would prefer to be taken care of, then this kind of system might appeal to you. You know, you don't have to worry about taking care of yourself, making your own decisions. Now, if on the other hand, you're a person who loves freedom and is willing to, you know, accept the consequences of their actions and their decisions and is willing to, you know, put up with ups and downs and take care of themselves and in return have the liberty that that's associated with, now that's not so appealing. But if you can convince people that the collective is supreme, individuality is bad, we should be working for the collective, you don't have to worry, the mommy government is always here to take care of you, it's almost as if they're trying to replace the function that was played by religion, you know, this belief in a supreme being that will be there to care for you and that, you know, after you die, everything is going to be okay. So it's like the state has tried to usurp some of these attributes and just create a kind of dependence. And once you are dependent on the system, it becomes much more difficult to object, because if your sustenance come, you know, the old expression, don't bite the hand that feeds you. If your sustenance is coming from this entity, how can you question it?
Yeah, exactly. I think, I've commented on this before. In Denmark, I think the government is the biggest employer, and it's not far off in Sweden either. A lot of people are in the public sector in one way or another, and this is also what many people seek to do. They seek to find a so-called comfortable position within the government, which entails security, I guess. We're now in the service economy. It's no production being done anymore, so people are just pushing papers back and forth, and nothing, you know, real and tangible is actually being done. But again, if you're in on that, if you can have that position, it's a very comfortable zone for you. And again, we're back to that idea. Then why would you speak out against that? Why would you criticize that? You have it, you know, good. You can pay your boat loans or whatnot, and and things are good, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people who would like to rule other people have understood this for a long time. If you can create dependence on the system that you're trying to build, it becomes much easier to rule over people. And they've done this in the United States. They've done this all over the world.
Yeah.
You've tried to figure out, okay, you know, who do we need support from to be able to build this system? We need farmers, so we'll implement farm subsidies. We need labor unions, so we'll pass all these laws favorable to labor unions. We need bureaucrats, so we will take control of all the bureaucracies and manipulate them in a top-down type of way. We need voters, so we'll, you know, implement these welfare schemes where we have half or, you know, close to half of the population dependent in some way or another on the government for either their health care or their food stamps or whatever it is. And so what they do is they just create dependence on the sectors that they need to be dependent to continue building their system. And at that point, it becomes very, very hard to break free from it. And people can't even imagine another system.
Yeah.
In Sweden, when you see the subsidies for the press, to me, that's the ultimate example of that.
Yeah. It's insidious. It's devious. I mean, how can we even expect to get a decent reporting coming out on government behavior when that's the case? I don't even know how it's been allowed. The fact is, I think, Alex, most people don't even know about it.
I think that's true. Yeah, they've never thought about it. They've never questioned it. They've never had any reason to. Swedish people, if you ask them, yeah, of course we have freedom of speech. Of course we have freedom of the press. And I mean, more than, you know, maybe Afghanistan, yeah. Do you have true freedom of the press here? Is there true freedom of speech? Absolutely not.
Yep.
And just the subsidies for the you know, media industry is such an infringement on freedom of speech, because then all the only voices that will be heard are the voices that are approved by the government. And you know, that's the kind of system that people who would like to rule over other people have longed for all over the place. That they've been trying to do that in the United States. We have things like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they've started with these things, but we still have a pretty vibrant free press. We still have newspapers in every big city basically that are supported by advertising. So not that we have a great press in the United States, we have our own problems. They're separate
sure.
from Swedish yeah. ones, but at least it's not dependent on the government for its existence.
Well, it's a good point. I also think that environment also creates individual incentives, if you will, that you have individual journalists over there that can make it. They are driven. They have a reason to go out and find the scoop, find the story, find the real truth about a event, whatever has happened, or scandal, what have you. But here it's quite the opposite. They're sitting around waiting for what the authorities have to say about the event, and then they simply report on that. It's much more detrimental. I agree with you. America certainly has their problems with the corporate press and money being behind it, perhaps instead of just the government. But I'd rather think have that than what is currently in Sweden. How, what do you think about the mandatory license fees if you have a television, for instance?
That's so crazy. It's just more of this, you know, government trying to control everything. It's, I mean, owning the TV stations. I guess there's a few private ones now, but owning, you know, subsidizing the newspapers. Almost all the radio stations here are what, at least subsidized, if not outright run by the government. And so voices of dissent are very few and far between. I think your program is one of the few alternative voices that I've come across, you know, with any serious degree of influence since I've been in Sweden.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Wow. So they have license fees on the television, public broadcasting, obviously they call it, but it's not as a concept, as you said, that exists with PBS over in America, where you rely then on public donation or basically simply if you like the program or if you want to watch the program or the channel, I guess, then you pay a little bit for it to fund it, right? But in this case, it's like saying, well, if you put it the reverse, it's like if you go out and buy a TV, then they can enforce you to pay money to for this license, basically, because you might look at their channels. It would be like me saying, well, I have a website on the internet, and since you can reach that potentially, I'm going to send you a bill for that now, Alex. How about that?
Yeah, and it's just so absurd. I do think that media reform would go a long way toward, you know, at least getting people to ask some questions. And in Sweden, we're at the point where, you know, just asking questions would be a big step forward.
That shows how bad it is, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. There are a lot of nice things that I like about Sweden. But, you know, you hear plenty of that from the government subsidized newspapers. So we can talk about, you know, the other side that yeah, people don't get to hear about nearly as much.
That's right. We can talk about, and we can do another program on all the things we like. I don't think it would be a whole program, though, but we can focus on the things we don't like for now. Okay, well, how about the history here, if we go into that a little bit? I think that there's two defining aspects that has shaped the current system that we're in. Obviously, beginning with the concepts of folkhemmet is a very difficult word to translate. Maybe you have a better concept about this or a translation for it. It's basically a concept about how the Swedish people should live or should act as well within the country, and this has been the ruling model for the Social Democratic Party that has had a grip, an iron fist clenched on the country for almost 100 years now, with very, very brief interludes of being out of power. And then you have the crash back in the 90s that also started a very, very fine program of public-private partnership and things like that, privatization of certain things that was paid for and taken care of by the government and by the people that were later sold out. So we've kind of suffered, I think, the worst of both systems, and that's where the end result is now, where we're kind of living in the borderline twilight zone in between these two systems. How would you define it, or if we look at some of the history of this, Alex?
Yeah, I think a big part of the reforms that came in the last decade or so had a lot to do with self-preservation, because the system as it stood was not able to continue. The government was so big, the country was becoming so unproductive. I mean, before, you know, the Social Democrats took over and started growing the government to monstrous proportions, Sweden had a relatively free economy. It was becoming very, very wealthy very quickly. And then you had this regime foisted on the country that suddenly tried to centrally plan and regulate and control everything and sometimes outright own it. And that system was falling apart. You know, Sweden had built up a lot of wealth. The Swedish people have a long history. You know, the Protestant work ethic, they're hardworking. They have a cohesive society. So they were able to keep the system sputtering along, you know, and people still living at an acceptable standard of living for a while. But it eventually got to the point where they understood that the system would crash if they didn't make reforms. And so they did make some reforms just out of self-preservation, because if the system crashed, they might lose their whole precious creation. And so what they saw was, okay, well, we have to implement some kind of at least facade of market reforms and implement some more market mechanisms, because if not, our monster system here is going to crash down. And so they did that. And some of those, I think, have been positive. In some ways, it's actually gotten to the point where it's better than the United States system today. But
can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, For example, I was looking at a study in I think it was Mississippi. If you're a person who made about $15,000 or $17,000 a year working, you know, at McDonald's or something like that, after you add in all of the state and federal and local subsidies like food stamps and housing assistance and wealth redistribution and earned income tax credit and free health care and these types of things, you would have a disposable income, a total income of about $36,000 per year. Now, if you were an executive working 80 hours a week and earning $60,000 a year, you would be taxed so heavily that you would have less overall final income at the end of the year than this person who was working at McDonald's and getting all the subsidies.
Wow.
So your motivation then would be to quit your job, go find a, you know, a job at McDonald's, and then have more money than you would have had if you had been busting your butt, working as hard as you possibly could to get up in a high position.
Yeah.
And so Sweden isn't that bad anymore. Sweden has reformed the system in a lot of ways where there's still a lot of wealth redistribution, but it's nothing like that. America has just literally taken it to this point of extreme that, you know, if there isn't reform, it's going to end badly, I'm sure of it.
Isn't that part of the destruction of the middle class something that I consider, and I mean, we haven't had here in Sweden for a long time? I think we have a aristocratic, super wealthy upper class, and then we have everybody else. And within that class, if you will, it's not really a lower class. It's just like the only class, if I can put it that way.
Everybody else, yeah, the peasant.
And within that, it's all kind of, well, pretty mediocre, if I can put it that way. It doesn't mean that people are, well, again, there are problems with homelessness in Sweden. There are people starving. It is getting worse as well on top of that, especially now during the economic crisis and situation. But it's nothing like it is in some of the other countries in Europe right now, obviously. So we haven't suffered at all to that extent. Because I've always said that the economist here has been flatlined. We haven't perhaps suffered as much as, you know, other countries when the economy has been bad. But we didn't benefit when the economy was booming either, if you know what I mean, Alex.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And your comments about the middle class, I think that's spot on once again. People who have wanted to rule over other people have always recognized the middle class as their biggest threat because they have disposable wealth that they can use in defense of their liberty. They have a good motivation to defend themselves against tyranny. They want to keep, you know, their status, their wealth, their family. They want to preserve things as they are. So historically, totalitarians have always sought to smash the middle class, whether they called it the bourgeoisie or any other fancy term. They realize that the middle class is the strongest point of resistance to totalitarian schemes. And so you see all over the world in the United States, all over the world, I should say, where there still is a middle class.
Right, yeah.
And that's particularly obvious in the United States. Obama's always talking about taxing the rich and all these different ploys, but that's not what he really means. What he's doing and what the people who are allied with him are doing is they're waging a war on the middle class. I'm 100% convinced of it. And the reason that is because the middle class is the last bastion of resistance to infinitely larger government. So the elites like this idea. The elites have pretty much constructed this system. The poor have been misled into supporting this system by, as I mentioned earlier, becoming dependent on it, taking their food stamps and getting their free health care. And so they've been put into a situation of dependence where they can't object, and they feel that if the system came down, their sustenance would go with it. And so now all that's left is the middle class. And once that's gone, it's not going to be pretty.
No, I agree. It's horrendous. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about this idea of incentives or why you should, you know, try harder, why you should work harder if you indeed have the capability of doing so. I think it creates, if we look at the flip side and look at some of the aspects here in Sweden, then I think it creates an environment where things are so equal, egalitarian, if you will, that it doesn't really, how should I put it, it doesn't really matter if you work harder or try harder, because the infrastructure for utilizing that ability or that your drive isn't really there. So what I've seen, Alex, and I want to get your take on this as well as an American and then live as one who's living in Sweden as well, service goes down the drain. You don't really have an interest in maybe the mom and pop kind of stores anymore. There aren't very few of these around in Sweden. Maybe there's more up around in the Stockholm area where you are. But in the rest of the country, I don't see it. It's chains or nothing at all. And this also means that you don't have any people personally associated with the store. They simply work at a franchise and basically have no answers for anything. If you ask for details about whatever, you know, it doesn't matter if you're in a technical store or at a restaurant to a certain degree. And so anyway, what I see that is that that's very, very detrimental to the idea of offering good service. And at least for now, in the meantime here, what I've noticed when I've been over to America, that you have a different think there. It doesn't mean that you have one who is less paid, that is a slave to the other ones that have to now then, you know, say please and thank you and be very kind to get a good tip. It's not about that either. It's just, from my point of view, what I've been able to see is it just creates a nicer environment, actually, to be honestly, you know, about that. But I don't see that in Sweden. What's your view on this as an American? Because I have for a long time struggled with people in Sweden. It's very cold, very detached. No one is better than anybody else. Everyone is equal. It's on the same page. So therefore, it's not that individuals come and meet each other and have respect for each other. It's more like a workers' ant, you know, community, if I can put an analogy in there. I don't know. What do you think, Alex?
No, I agree with your assertion a lot, actually. I don't know how much different the United States is anymore. But what you're saying, I think, is very real. What we were talking about, creating dependence on the system. So you have to wipe out smaller businesses and the middle class and create a dependence on either the super corporations or the government. And you do lose the incentive. Now, Sweden takes it almost to the point of an extreme where success is actually frowned upon. You know, how dare you work so hard to try to become better than us and have more money? That's not appropriate. You know, you must be a greedy individualist. And so the mindset here has definitely, in my opinion, gone to an extreme. Now, that hasn't really come to the United States yet, but we've had the same kind of concerted effort to smash independent businesses, to smash independent, you know, family-type enterprises and that kind of stuff, because that creates a great degree of independence. It creates a great degree of pride. And, if you can go get everybody to go work at Walmart or IKEA, then, like you said, you just kind of become a worker ant colony of just drones. And that's what the public school system, if you actually go back and look at what its founders and what the original promoters of this idea, that's what they wanted. They wanted a system where people would just kind of do their work in a robotic fashion, and you know, all the wealth could be sucked away to the very, very tippy top. And it's, you know, this is what we're seeing today. This is the fruits of it. And I think it'll get worse before it gets better, at least unless people start complaining about it pretty soon.
Yeah, you're right. Homeschooling is an area you've written quite a bit about. I do want to talk more in detail about this, perhaps in the second hour. We'll see how we go here. But the fact that you mentioned that it's frowned upon to be successful, I think it definitely harkens back to the Jante law, Jantelagen, basically an unwritten rule. It's 10, I think, included in there. I don't know where it comes from. I've tried to find the original, you know, origin point of it. It was originally described in a book written by a Danish author many, many years ago now. And it just details some of these problems that arise, you know, there. But have you heard about Jantelagen, Alex, and what do you make of it? I mean, it's horrible.
Actually, your mention of it is, I think, the first time that I've heard the term. So.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Is that true?
I think so.
It basically, it's a 10 dotted list of rules that basically say, you know, don't think you're better than anybody else. You know, don't think you're, and it was described originally, or written down originally to describe the mentality of the Scandinavians, I think. And it kind of semi-humorously, but the fact is that it has been the unwritten law here for a long, long time. And I think we're still seeing the vestiges of this, and therefore it's still within the cultural mentality. And I'm not going to go through the whole list, you know, all 10 points of them. I can link them up for people so they can read them for themselves. It's available even on Wikipedia and stuff like that. But basically the outline of it is, you know, don't think you're special. Don't think you know anything extra. It's very, very anti-individual and just pro-collective. And I can't help to think that this is something that's been released out there, if you know what I mean, Alex, at an early stage, perhaps when there was worse control back in the 1600s, 1700s, perhaps the Lutheran Church had an iron grip around Sweden as well at that point. Don't know. It's just speculation. But that's definitely something for you to look into then, Alex, because I think that would explain maybe perhaps this mentality and where it comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes back to what I was saying, too, about these preschool students. I spent a long time talking with a girl who teaches preschool and who, you know, went through the university program to learn how to do that. And like I said before, Vygotsky is one of their main influences. And if you actually look through his writings, one of the key points that I took away from it is this notion that you have to crush individuality from an early age. And the idea was that you should shame children. If the children don't want to be part of the group, or if they don't think like part of the group, then they should be shamed into submission. They should feel bad to have a different opinion or to want to do something different. And I mean, they're getting this into the kids at a very, very young age. And I guess, you know, this is pretty much the results of it. It's a society where it's frowned upon to be different, where it's frowned upon to try to be successful. And it's, you know, it's disheartening, I think, for sure.
What do you make of the, I call it at this point war on gender, actually, with the preschool here in Sweden being the primer kind of to release this out in the media. To check the temperature on what the consensus is out there, I feel, in Stockholm. They began at the preschool here to simply stop calling boys him and girls her and came up with this other genderless pronoun, I guess. And I just think it's really, 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 really bad. And the fact is that it's also, I believe anyway, that it's at a time when you don't even think about gender in, from the point of view of sexuality, even. But it's almost like this is now being worked so hard against 180 degrees that they're come up with rules that are trying to define these kids as not being anything of this at a stage in their lives when they're simply not. I mean, kids are asexual in that way. I think very few kids think about it at all, maybe because parents or something bring it to their attention, perhaps. I don't know. But what do you make of this story about egalitarianism kind of running amok in Sweden, and this preschool here has gotten a lot of flack for doing this? What do you make of it, Alex?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the story, this preschool Egalia, and to be honest, I mean, that's, you know, maybe the most extreme example we can point to, but I don't think it's that far out of the realm of what has become normal in Sweden. I think it's really, really frightening what this social engineering, it's almost sick to me, this social engineering that these people are so obsessed with making sure that every kid in all of Sweden believes this exact same nonsense about gender. And I mean, ultimately, I think this has to fail. They're arguing against nature, and they're arguing against common sense, and they're arguing against biology. So at some point, I think it becomes absurd and people will see it as such. But there's so much resources being poured into this campaign to, you know, abolish gender roles and all this stuff. And I think it's going to have very, very negative repercussions in the long term. I think some of those are already starting to emerge here in Sweden. And I think as this kind of stuff gets more extreme and as the younger generations grow up, I think we're going to see a lot of psychological problems stemming from this kind of stuff. And I think it's just a giant experiment, and I don't think it's going to turn out well, to be honest.
This has also taken a toll on some of the military symbolism out there. I remember a while back there was a lion symbol that got its balls snipped from the symbol because there was some women military that were offended by the fact that this lion, you know, with the an emblem basically for one of the military, you know, factions in Sweden. Had some balls hanging out there, you know, and so they had to take that away.
Oh,
so, yeah, well, there you go. What would you say to some of those people that think that this is a great thing, Alex? That finally, you know, they are abolishing this gender nonsense, and the men has had way too much power for a long time, and it's about time we see some, you know, equality in all this. What would you say to them? What is some of the dangers with this, as you see it?
Well, I think the biggest reason why this is so dangerous, and I think this is also the key reason why the elite of the world have supported these kind of women liberation and feminism and these types of things so heavily, it's because the family unit is pretty much the building block of civilization. If people have families, they don't need to rely on government. You know, if you lose your job, you ask your family for help. And so as long as you have this cohesive social structure that transmits values, that provides security, then the state almost becomes irrelevant. And so if you're a totalitarian and you want to rule over people, you identify this family as a big problem, a big impediment to your goals, and so you wage a war on it. And what better way to do that than by running around saying that women are oppressed and the patriarchy is evil and that children need to go to government daycare when they're 1 year old, and that women all need to go do the exact same thing as men, and that there's no biological differences whatsoever. It's a social construct. I mean, if you wanted to destroy the family, that's what you would do. And that's what they have done. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, women have never not been treated equally. And I do think that
sure.
Some points in the feminist movement, maybe 100 years ago, had some validity. Women should be able to vote, hold property, and have, you know, equality under the law.
Of course.
But what we're talking about with this movement today isn't equality under the law. We're talking about redefining concepts that are ingrained in human nature, that have been there since the dawn of civilization. And this dismantling of the family, I mean, the repercussions of this are so humongous that I don't think that they can be understated. I mean, if they succeed in destroying the family, which they are very viciously trying to do, you know, the state then becomes the family, the state becomes God, and you pave the way for, you know, communist, dictatorial, fascist type rule. And that's why, you know, I think this kind of stuff needs to be opposed. And in the end, I think it will be exposed for the absurdity that it is. But in the meantime, I think it's going to cause a lot of havoc along the way.
I think you're completely right. I think this is a very, very important point that you bring up. I don't think it has anything to do with a well-meaning agenda for true egalitarianism at all. I think it has to do with control of the human being. And as you say, of painting everybody to be so-called equal, meaning they're the same. They have a lack of expression of individuality, and this is sameness run amok, or oneness, if you want to put it that way. And I think it's very, very detrimental to culture, to society, to all human beings. And I think you're right. I think they are working against some of the rules of nature, things that have been there for thousands and thousands of years. But it's now being turned on its head as a political agenda, and we're being taught that these are just social constructs. But I think they're wrong on that note. I think there are physiological, and as you say, biological differences between people. Everybody is not equal. It's never been about that. I think that this equality thing has run amok completely, and it's actually now to the point of being detrimental for all, where those who have the potential to do something extraordinary. Well, maybe only in sports this is still being, you know, kind of lifted up, I guess. But in all other regions of life, it's almost like they're trying to keep down those people who now have some extraordinary abilities. And I think Swedish society has been at the pinnacle of that for a long time. As I said before, the infrastructure for, well, I don't want to say like greatness or anything like that. It kind of sounds cheesy, but the fact is that some people are naturally talented at certain things. And this has almost been something that they want to snip away at in Swedish society. Take away those aspects, kind of, you know, hammer them back into normality, so to speak. And then it'll be better for all. Very detrimental, I think. Anything you want to add to that, Alex?
Yeah, absolutely. The term equality, it's just so sad that they've been able to hijack it, I think is a good way to describe it. Because equality, in the true sense, we're all equal under the law. We're all equal before God. We all have equal protection under the law. We all have equal rights. But to turn that into this notion that we all need to be exactly the same, and that if we're not exactly the same as everybody else, then something is wrong and the government needs to step in and do social engineering, it's just a sick notion. You know, each individual, each human being is beautiful in their own way. They have their own talents, their own unique abilities, their own desires, their own goals. And to try to create these cookie cutter people, you know, and it's not even a nice cookie cutter.
That's right. It's
a monstrous image. It just strips the humanity away from people. And it's really sad. And they've used the term equality, and they've hijacked it, and they've turned it into, you know, something horrible, something monstrous. Whereas equality, it's, you know, the original notion, it's a noble goal that we should all have equal protection, we should all have equal rights and so forth. And they've just turned it into, you know, an absurdity. And it's really sad, the consequences. And we're just starting to see them now. I think, you know, 2 decades from now, we're going to see this rearing its ugly head even more fully. And just, you know, the things that make humanity great, the things that make life worth living, differences and individuality, they just want to smother it all. They just want to smash it all. And, I mean, what kind of world are you left with then? Someone, you know, people who like this idea, they should go check out North Korea and see how well that worked. It doesn't work at all.
That's right. This is Some of these ideas, I believe, also goes back to people like Edward Bernays.
Absolutely.
You know, the guy behind the word propaganda, Sigmund Freud's nephew. Marketeers and political strategists have been using, I think, as well, the energy of well-meaning grassroots movements, if it has to do with women liberation or some of the other things out there as well, to slightly steer this energy towards an agenda or towards something that would benefit them at the end. And it's very, again, very, very insidious. And I think one of the problems I see as well, Alex, is that people, these are subjects that people act emotionally about or react emotionally about, meaning it becomes very difficult to have a rational, you know, conversation where you kind of, for a moment at least, then bypass the emotions, try to look at it for what it is and try to see how it's being used against us instead of being drawn into the emotional debate that whoever doesn't go along with this is some kind of anti-feminist, I guess, or something else, whatever subject we talk about, anti-equality or whatever. Again, I'm on your page there, Alex. I don't think this is not what it's about at all. This is ultimately about control. And how do we, I think, in your opinion, then, work against some of this? Is it about, as I said before, try to look at it irrationally, try to disconnect from the emotions for a little bit and try to look at it objectively, if you will? Is it about learning and studying? Or is there something else we should do, need to do to understand the strategy that is being used against us?
Yeah, like you mentioned, they've really created this through, you know, intense conditioning. It's almost like a Pavlov's dog's reaction where, you know, you hear any question about feminism and suddenly you have all these pre-programmed reactions. Oh, this person must be a fascist, patriarchal person who hates equality and wants women to stay in the kitchen all day and cook.
Right, right.
And so you need to try to, I don't know, approach the issue in a way that doesn't immediately elicit that reaction. So, you know, maybe disarm that immediate emotional response so that it's possible to get past that and have a rational dialogue and explain things. Because when you're fighting against the emotional aspect of something, you know, facts and reason and logic, those don't work. And so I think the key then is to disarm the immediate emotional response and then try to have conversations and try to educate based on, you know, the reality of things. You can go back and you can show the facts. You can look at the history of the feminist movement and see who was supporting it. It's, you know, the Rockefeller families, all these huge nonprofit foundations.
Yep.
And so you say, well, why would they do that? These people are supposed to be, you know, the enemies. They're supposed, you know, the capitalists hate them, the communists hate them, everybody hates them. So why would they be funding this? And if they're funding it, you know, what were their motives? And should I be reexamining these things? And at some point, I think once people learn enough about even just one or two or three different aspects of what we're talking about, then at some point, because it happened to me, you just start to question everything and you have to go back. Yeah. And you have to say, okay, what did I learn in my life? Now, does that make sense? And where did I learn it? And what was the purpose of it? And then you just reexamine everything and you keep what makes sense. You keep what was valuable and you scrutinize other things more closely and you see whether what you previously thought was the truth was really the truth.
Very good. There are so many aspects that we haven't touched upon yet that I want to ask you about. Homeschooling, I want to talk about it a little bit more about some of the origins of this. I also want to try to get into the definition of what the system is and again how also a little bit more on how it's being promoted around the world. Religion is being attacked as being hate speech and things like this. It's very, very interesting times here and things are moving ahead quickly, although the changes and the movements politically that I talked about before has kind of been glacial in Sweden. It still, on certain aspects, goes pretty quick here. Norway recently abolished Christianity as state religion. And on the surface, again, you might think, well, you know, that's great then. Maybe they would go more in line with something like the United States, for instance, which I think is really good, where it's founded on no religion or religious freedom, if you will, that, you're free to worship whatever you want. But in this case, I unfortunately think that they're kind of stuck in a religion of their own. And I want to get into this a little bit more in the next hour, talk about homeschooling that you've been written about as well, writing about, Alex. But let's talk a little bit about where people can find your writing. If you have your own personal website out there, if you collect your articles or essays in a specific place where we can go, is it a little bit scattered out there? Tell us about this, Alex.
Yeah, actually, I've been meaning to do that for a long time, put up a personal website just collecting all of the different work and the different writings I've done, but I actually have not done that yet. So if people are interested in reading anything I've written or, you know, getting in touch with me, they can add me on Facebook. It's just Alex Newman. If you do a Google search for my name and basically any keyword about anything we've talked about today or any of the other, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of issues that I've written about, you'll find it through there. Probably my biggest clients in terms of writing articles, The New American is probably the magazine that I write for the most. It's, in my opinion, a great liberty-minded American publication that deals with a lot of the really serious issues of today in terms of liberty and geopolitics and these types of things. I've written for a lot of others. I write for American Daily Herald, Crisis Magazine, working on another piece for Liberty Magazine right now. The most recent one I did for them was about the homeschooling issue here in Sweden and how so many families are being forced to escape. And yeah, just if you search around the web, you'll find a lot of my stuff. I've written for a lot of newspapers, a lot of different magazines, and do a couple of other things on the side as well. So,
really good. Great stuff. Thank you, Alex. Stay with us here. We're going to talk more in the next segment. Again, then find Alex Newman on Facebook.com or check out The New American, Crisis Magazine, LibertyMagazine.com. We'll have some of these links up that Alex mentioned as well, so you can go find it. Really good. We'll be right back with more.
Yeah.
next hour with Alex Newman, we continue to shatter the illusion of the welfare state, the detrimental concepts of the Nordic model, and the anti-individual sentiments within Swedish society. We talk more about the banning of homeschooling and the government control of the curriculum, whether it's a private school or public school. We'll talk about the separation of state and religion, equality run amok, the obsession with security, and how it stifles development and growth, and instead breeds paranoia. Stay tuned to Red Ice Radio for more. Hour 2 is coming up in our members section. Subscribe at redicecreations.com. Listen to this or any of our previous programs. Don't miss out. Also, of course, don't miss Alex again towards the end of the week. He'll be with us for an extra show from Rio as a correspondent from the Earth Summit they're holding down there now in 2012. Before this, we are going to have Erik Karlström and Winter Lake with us. After this, we have Peter Halldorsson from Iceland, Nils Axel Mörner from Sweden, and then Helen Caldicott from Australia. Much more coming up with Alex Newman. Don't miss it.